You're listening to Lanyap, a weekly digest of news, personal finance, brotherly banter, and whatever else is on our minds. From Stokes Family Office.
It's Greg and Doug Stokes with Lanyap Podcast. Today is April 3rd, 2024. Wednesday. Doug and I are both recording remotely, so if there's any issues with audio, apologies in advance. It's been a wild week in the markets, per usual. The markets closed at an all-time high, I believe, on Friday, and then subsequently this week has been a couple of down days, which is not atypical from the standpoint of the beginning of the quarter or what have you, or end of the quarter. There's typically volatility surrounding when large institutional investors will rebalance their portfolios. But in any event, today, Wednesday, is a flat day. Jay Powell spoke earlier today, the chairman of the Fed, and basically said that he's seeing the data that he needs to see to continue down the path of cutting a couple times, 2 to 3 times this year, basically, is what the market's guessing at. Last week, PCE, which is the core inflation number that the Fed looks at very closely, came in at much lower than expected numbers. It was like 2.5%. The Fed's long-term target has been 2%, and we're sort of edging towards that. The Eurozone's inflationary numbers came in today, was at 2.5%. In general, inflationary numbers across the board have just been coming in around the globe softer than expected. And so the market's expecting that either in June or July, which is right around the corner, we're going to have a rate cut. And then, like I mentioned previously, we're going to have a total of two or three this year. It's kind of a coin flip as it stands right now. Doug, what do you make of what's going on in the market and in terms of what the Fed is doing? And we got a lot of things to talk about today, but I just want to get your thoughts on a big picture basis.
Yeah, I think the most surprising thing to me is that the 10-year Treasury moved up dramatically from something like 4.2% to 4.4% in the last couple of days, despite softer than expected inflation. And and the only thing that I can think that really drives that is going to be expectations of growth. So if we have inflation coming down, we have a soft or no landing at all, we have a reignition of economic growth, then you get a steepening yield curve where you have lower short-term rates and higher long-term rates, which is basically what a normal environment is and something we haven't seen for the better part of two and a half years now. And so that's what I'm estimating that, or guessing that what the 10-year is doing in terms of a move higher, is that expected long-term growth is higher, despite the fact that inflation is coming in. So that's great for economic data. It's great for the earnings power of companies long-term. And it's not great for, you know, highly leveraged vehicles, whether it's real estate investments or things like that, you know, highly levered companies that have floating rate debt. And so I think that that's really interesting to me, that everyone expected rate cuts equals lower bond yields, specifically expecting lower long-term bond yields. And we're almost getting the opposite of that now. We're going to get rate cuts with higher yields.
Right. To that point, I saw Jurian Timmer, who's the chief economist of Fidelity Investments, posted a long a tweet thread, but specifically stated that expectations for earnings growth in the S&P 500 are around 9% this year. So the market is expecting, and so it is surprising everyone, and he referred to the rationale behind the market bouncing back at the end of last year was that we would have a soft landing. And the idea is that we may have no landing now, meaning that the economy may just keep chugging along, and we're starting to have PE expansion, and we're going to have the underlying growth to work along with that. So things are looking really positive. And we talked about this offline, but along with the fact that treasury yields are a lot higher than what the market was expecting, oil specifically has really taken off, right? At the beginning of the year, oil was trading at like $70 a barrel, plus or minus. It dipped into the 60s at one point. Now it's Now it's $85 a barrel for oil. And there's a lot of different inputs that go into that, like specifically the supply and demand, obviously. So OPEC's been cutting. And demand data is starting to look better coming out of China. But from a macro big picture trend, the idea behind the utilization of electric cars would be a headwind against the price of oil. And that really hasn't turned out. And I saw, interestingly enough, Tesla came out with their quarterly numbers a couple of days ago, and they were under 400,000 cars delivered over the course of the quarter, which is the lowest that it's been in like 3 or 4 years. And the big investment theme of 2000, 2001, 2002 was electric cars and the electrification of the grid. And so the hot stocks at the tail end of COVID or in the midst of COVID were electric cars, Tesla, for example, Plug Power, Rivian, and so on and so on. And now the price of oil is basically at multi-year highs. Not multi-year highs, because it was higher not till right after the invasion of Russia. But Doug, I'd love to get your thoughts on that topic, and where you see things related to oil and electric cars and everything.
Well, I think it's the same story. I think when you have higher economic growth, higher output, you have higher utilization of commodities. And so, higher economic growth with declining reserves and declining drilling, whether you're disincentivizing drilling or you're a part of a cartel network that is pulling E&P offline, I think that's going to drive oil higher. But I think in the grand scheme of things, I think that a lot of this has to do with the fact that the economy is growing. What you see in recessions is you see the price of oil drop dramatically. And why do you see that? It's because economic output is declining. And so I think that's largely a reason why that oil prices are in the mid-80s. I also think that when you go through a large cycle of negative investment from 2015 to 2021, where you had a huge bust in after the shale boom, then you had electrification and renewable movement that really pulled dollars away from oil companies. So less and less oil companies were around competing. The ones that survived weren't drilling as much as what was being drilled before 2015. And so that's going to be a big driver of this new commodity wave. And I think that's the biggest risk to inflation right now. If you have commodity prices that are increasing, that really impacts everything from the price of gas to manufacturing expenses to cost of construction.
Airplane tickets.
That's all gonna have an impact on inflation long term. And I think that is a big risk. The other thing I think is a big risk to inflation long term is the fact that the real estate markets have basically been shut down for 2 years. And you had this major boom in construction and multifamily development in 2020, 2021, and early part of 2022. There basically has been no activity for the last couple of years. And so you're going to have a period of probably 26, 27, where very few new apartment buildings are going to be coming online. And what is that going to do to rent prices then once all the supply from COVID has been absorbed? And so you talk about, I don't think it is a given that inflation is going to be at 2% or below long term. I think it's heading that way absolutely short term. But when you have these two major movements, one, just a uninvestment or a decline in investment in exploration and production of oil over the last almost 10 years now. And then number two, you have this completely stalled commercial real estate sector for a couple of years. What is that going to look like in 2026, 2027?
Right. I think there's an interesting parallel between both oil and gas and and real estate in terms of the difficulty for both of those two sectors to obtain financing. And there's, and the difficulty exists for two different reasons. Oil and gas, the large institutions have ESG mandates, environmental, social governance. And so it's very difficult for any particular industries or any particular companies that exist in that industry or service that industry to obtain financing. And I've talked to people that, that own companies or manage companies in the oil and gas space, and that's a real issue because these large institutional investors simply just, they've precluded themselves from investing in the space. And so they just, the operators themselves can't obtain money. And so they have to self-finance or what have you, pay for it out of their cash flow. And then on the real estate side of the equation, a lot of real estate is financed by like regional banks. And as we've talked about ad nauseum, there's been a regional bank crisis for the last 2 or 3 years, although financials have been one of the best performing sectors of this particular year. But projects themselves are just having trouble getting off the ground just because banks are not lending as freely as they once were on the real estate side of the equation. So both of those two sectors have difficulty in obtaining financing. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Like right now, the price of oil is $85 a barrel, but the market prices oil futures several years out, and the market expects oil to go back to the 60s essentially by 2027.
I don't think there's any real issue with $85 a barrel oil. I think the issue is when it gets to $100, $110, $120 a barrel. So I don't think this is like any sort of cause for alarm, but I do think that you're going to have structurally higher oil prices until the animal spirits, the market drives people to want to drill because it's so lucrative again. And we may be getting there soon, but we just haven't had that for the last several years.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see what I don't think there's any difficulty for the large oil and gas players to obtain financing, but I'd be interested to see what the ramifications are of the difficulty in obtaining financing and the difficulty not only from the equities, the debt side of the equation, but the equity side of the equation has on energy in this particular cycle. And if that inherently is going to lead to stickier prices, just because it's going to throttle the ability for companies to explore. But we talked about this. We talked about this a couple of podcasts ago. That even though even if under the circumstances that there's a significant expansion of electric cars in the United States or globally or what have you, which I think is going to be a challenge inherently in the United States, but also in the developing world where their electric grids are so unreliable. But even under the circumstance that you have a mass adaptation or mass adoption of electric cars, the issue is that there's still going to be a need for internal combustion engine vehicles. And that's just evidenced by Norway, which has been incentivizing their citizens to buy electric cars, and two out of every three automobiles sold today in Norway are electric, but they're still using more gas than they were 10 years ago when they put this program into place, because people still need internal combustion engines for driving long distances or what have you. So I do think that there's going to be, I'm in the camp that there's going to be further adoption of electric vehicles as time goes on. I think that's sort of self-evident, but I do think that there's still going to be a need for fossil fuels. And a lot of times what's being burned to power those electric cars is fossil fuels anyway. So we've joked about that the electric vehicles are external combustion engines because they're just burning fuel elsewhere to plug those things in and charge them or whatever. But in any event, it's an interesting topic and something we'll be following closely as time goes on. I want to shift gears to talk about just a couple brief items. Sam Bankman-Fried, the head of what was the name of that exchange?
FTX.
FTX, which was a crazy time. He had like Tom Brady as one of his spokesmen, Larry David, etc. And anyway, it was a Ponzi scheme, and he was sentenced to 25 years in jail. Fortunately for the people that had their money tied up in that exchange, they recovered everything, which is not uncommon in Ponzi schemes. I saw this, interestingly enough, I saw 90%, there was a 90% recovery for Madoff, and in a lot of corporate bankruptcies themselves too. Something like, if you have a corporate bankruptcy, which doesn't happen that often, thankfully, the average recovery is like 60% or something like that. But I saw this quote from Morgan Housel related to that, and he said an uncomfortable statistic is the percentage of hedge fund and mutual funds that did worse than investing with Madoff. Which, if you look at John Hussman's fund, which we've talked about previously, he falls in that camp as well too. Another topic I thought was pretty interesting, and Doug, feel free to interject at any time, is Mexico's unemployment is now lower than the US, UK, and Germany. Mexico's unemployment is sub 3%. And on that same note, Mexico's peso last week rose to the strongest level against the US dollar since 2015. And they've been a primary benefit. It's been an interesting dichotomy. The success of Mexico and the failure of China over the last decade. And a large part of that has to do with the tariffs that were put into place and the fact that we've been more apt to do business with a friendly neighbor than a long distance adversary. And Mexico has really done excellent. I saw interestingly enough that Monterrey, Mexico, which is the state that it's a big industrial hub in northeast Mexico, their per capita GDP is now higher than the U.S. state, the lowest U.S. state's per capita GDP, which is Mississippi. So on average, the residents of Monterrey, Mexico, make more money per year than Mississippians, which is crazy to me. Obviously, Mexico is still a very, if you go further south in Mexico, it's absolutely a developing country. And on the whole, their per capita GDP is significantly lower than the United States. But there's a lot of development going on there, and I think it's really, really positive trend for Mexico and for the United States because they're a friendly neighbor.
Yeah, I'll say I'm very bullish on this onshoring and reshoring theme long term, and I think COVID really opened up some cracks that were forming. Pre-COVID, just basically total reliance upon China and Southeast Asia to produce goods for American consumers, when you could easily get similarly priced labor a lot closer with a much more friendly neighbor. I will say that the caveat there is that if Trump does get elected, there is definitely some posturing around making sure that immigration, illegal immigration to the United States is reversed, and a lot of pressure will be put on Mexico to get that done. And so we'll see what that pressure looks like, and it could be impactful to Mexico, at least short term, until that gets sorted out. But I think that from a secular tailwind perspective, having a neighbor be a major manufacturing and product driven importer for our exporter to us, importer United States as the importer, is just a really positive move long term. And I think that a lot of the things that we see related to shipping issues or geopolitical issues can be resolved by moving a lot of this manufacturing labor south of our border.
Right, exactly. So in the United States, the markets are doing really well. Like we've talked about, where the S&P 500 was, it was plus 10% on the quarter, so did really great. And that is, we've talked about it, that it's counterintuitive, but when markets are high or at highs, which we're near highs right now, then that usually begets more highs. And when the market is 10% or higher through the first quarter, that's usually really bullish as well too. We've talked about that the last podcast, so hopefully that historical rule comes into play in this case. Although there's no guarantees, obviously, This is an interesting quote interesting quote and chart that was posted by Charlie Bellello. And quoting Charlie Munger, the deceased partner of Warren Buffett. The first rule of compounding is to never interrupt it unnecessarily. And this is a chart that to post to the show notes, but the total returns for the last 10 years, March 20th, 2014 to March 20th, 2024. Over that 10-year period of time, the markets have compounded out at 12.8%, or you got 236% cumulative returns over that period of time. But if you would have sold at the bottom in COVID, your annualized rate of return, and you would have stayed in cash since over that period of time, which is not, it sounds ridiculous, but there are people that did this. If you would have made that decision and sold at the bottoms of COVID, your annualized rate of return would be 3.1%. Going back to what Munger said, the first rule of compounding is to never interrupt it unnecessarily. And that's certainly evidence in that particular case.
I think that's the golden rule. And we had plenty of people that were nervous at the bottom of COVID, and thankfully only very few that wanted to do anything about it. Those that did quickly bought back in. And so I think that we don't really have a whole lot of people that were connected with it that made that fatal error. But I think that there's always going to be something unexpected around the corner that causes volatility, causes decline in markets, and causes investors to want to sell. And I think having that discipline to be able to look throughout history and say, if I had not done anything and just let this high quality asset compound over time and accept volatility, then I'll be better off. And I think that chart is just a great example of showing the power of doing nothing, just buying something of really high quality and leaving it alone.
Right. It's kind of like the scene in Forgetting Sarah Marshall when the surfing instructor says do less over and over again when he's doing nothing. But it's kind of that's the same mentality you have to have when you're investing in any long-term asset, is just not interrupt it like that. Real quick, I want to close on an interesting observation. I haven't watched any women's college basketball, I don't think ever. But I watched the Iowa-LSU game this past weekend, and it was really entertaining and a lot of energy and all that kind of stuff. And I saw that this is Iowa is playing, I don't know who they're playing this, and actually they're playing Connecticut in the semifinal, Final Four on Friday. And the average ticket for that particular game is $2,300, which is it's more than twice as much for the men's semifinal game, which is pretty awesome, I think. And my daughter was loving it. I think it's awesome.
Basically, Caitlin Clark is probably the best college basketball player, men's and women's, from a dominance perspective against competition of all time. And so you got to go out and see it. It could be her last game.
Yeah, it'll be fun. But as usual, guys, we appreciate you joining us. We'll be signing off, and we'll be joining you through our normal recording modes. Our recording quality will be better. But in the meantime, if you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your friends and family. Give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen. But in the meantime, hope you have a great week, and we'll be with you next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Lanyap. This podcast is brought to you by Stokes Family Office. If you liked this episode, consider sharing it with a friend. You can subscribe to future episodes in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information about Stokes Family Office and Lanyap, visit us at stokesfamilyoffice.com. The information in this podcast is educational and general in nature and does not take into consideration the listener's personal circumstances. Therefore, it is not intended to be a substitute for specific, individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a final decision.